All right. Good morning, everyone. let's begin. Excuse me. Our shiur this morning is dedicated by Sori Reiner in loving memory of her mother, Hannah Rachel Bas Binyamin Chaim, and her grandmothers, Frege Bas Yaakov Halevi and Frege Bas Shmuel. Excuse me. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, the Neshamas will have an aliyah and the family in Nechama. It also goes without saying that our hearts are broken over the incredible tragedy that occurred yesterday in Jersey City, with the full extent and understanding of these events not yet fully known, but we dedicate our learning... I'm sorry. You know, ladies, I would request, maybe there's a whole bunch of seats over here, just to make it... I'll even position myself like this a little bit if it's easier. Maybe... It might just be just a bit easier. I'm sorry. I'll try to speak louder as well. I was mentioning that we are all familiar at this point in time with the tragedy that occurred in Jersey City. The victims whose names have been released, Moshe Hirsch-Deutsch, Mrs. Leah Mindel-Ferentz, and there may be other victims still to be identified, as well as Detective Joseph Seals, who was the 45-year-old detective from the Jersey City Police Department, murdered in cold blood, a father of five children. For Am Yisrael, we're no stranger to tragedies, unfortunately. And here is just yet another part of our heart that is splintered for such seemingly senseless and baseless hatred. The Esav Sone Es Yaakov, the hatred sometimes that the world brings down to bear upon our people is so overwhelming and so difficult to comprehend. But we hope then in the merit of our Talmud Torah that their neshamas have an aliyah and their families in a chama. It's also very important, you know, we live in a time where there is so much negativity that is often directed towards the police department. And sometimes it's because of bad things they do, and sometimes it's because of shortcomings they have. But it's incredibly important to realize that there are men and women who put on the uniform of the police department each and every day and are willing to put themselves in harm's way to protect people that they don't know, to protect people that they will never meet. And so it's incredibly important that we express our hakaras hatov, that we express our gratitude towards the men and women of the police force. And I mean that like just in a cognitive way, but also in simple gestures. Like if you're buying a cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts or at 7-Eleven or you're anywhere and there's a police officer there, treat them. Because at the end of the day, they're always willing to put their lives on the line for us. And here is a family, this Detective Seals, I don't know, a 40-year-old detective from Jersey City who lost his life, who was murdered at point-blank range and leaves behind a widow, five young children. It's tragic. It's tragic that senseless murders like this have to happen. It's tragic that our people are seemingly targeted for no apparent reason. Kadosh Baruch Hu should give all of their neshamas an aliyah and their families an achama. And with that, let us begin. Today we're going to focus probably this week, and again, I also want to mention there is no class next week. There are schedules in the back because the next couple of weeks are a little bit sporadic. So you'll take the schedules in the back. They tell you the schedule of this class through the end of this semester. So we're going to focus this morning on Kapitel Samech Dalet. David HaMelech writes as follows. Lam Natseach Mizmor LeDavid. Shema Elokim Kol B'sichi Mipachod Oyev Titzar Chayai. Literally translated, Hear, O God, my voice in prayer. From fear of the enemy, you shall guard my life. Tastirini Misod Mireim Merikshas Poale Oven. Literally translated, You shall hide me from the council of evildoers, from the gathering of workers of iniquity. Asher Shanenu Kacherev Lushonam. Who whetted their tongues like the sword, who aimed a bitter word like their arrow. So David HaMelech goes on to describe, and again, thematically, many of the commentaries on Tehillim link Kapitel Samech Gimel with Samech Dalet, 63 and 64 are very much linked. What's the theme? David HaMelech lamenting his enemies. Lamenting his enemies and really highlighting the fact that his enemies took aim at him, although we'll see who exactly is the subject of this capital. His enemies took aim of him really in two different ways. With their actions, but also with their words. David HaMelech speaks about this a lot throughout Tehillim. You know, I think, although I don't know if it's as popular anymore, but we used to teach our children, or many of us are taught as children, sticks and stones may break our bones, but words will never harm us. And the truth is, it doesn't take long to actually see that those words are unequivocally false. Right? In fact, sometimes the wounds that are inflicted with words are much longer lasting than any physical injury. Bruises heal, but emotional trauma often does not. People go through a whole life. It's interesting that David HaMelech has two different types of people in his life. He has people who are trying to physically kill him, like his father-in-law, like many others, who, because he thinks that he's a traitor to the crown. And then, excuse me, and then he has other people who are just maligning him. We've mentioned many times throughout this series that the episode with Bathsheba forever colored David HaMelech's life, to the point that the Gemara relates in a dramatic way that whenever David HaMelech would walk into the Beis Medrash, so people would ask him a simple question, say, David, what is the punishment for someone who commits adultery? They were taunting him. And David HaMelech would often say, it is true, one who commits adultery is chayiv misa, is liable to death, but he has a portion in the world to come. But amal bin pnei chaveiro berabim, someone who embarrasses his friend in public, not only dies in this world, but has no portion in the world to come as well. David HaMelech deals with the constant maligning, constant negative words of those around him. And you see, when he describes those words, he describes them as arrows. Not simply discomfort, but the arrow pierces the flesh. The arrow could take life. The words of my enemies are like arrows which pierce me. And again, the capital then goes on, seemingly echoing the same basic idea. My enemies come upon me physically, verbally. My enemies attack me with their hands. They attack me with their words. And by the way, just this idea with words, we see this contemporarily in such a dramatic way. Because I'm fine. I'm fine, I promise. Thank you. Now I'm good. We see this in such a dramatic way, which is that at the end of the day, how words are used today, even in contemporary society. It's an incredible thing. What you can do with a tweet, and by the way, don't think that that's a comment about the president, because everyone does it. What you could do with a tweet, what you could do on social media, what you could do on a blog, the way you could destroy people's lives, literally with just a word, with just a sentence. And again, it used to be, you know, when you said something or you wrote something, there was very limited impact, right? What's the impact? The impact is the people who hear you and the people who are right next to you. Today, the power of the written word is global. It's global. You could put something out into the public sphere, build people, because words could be used in positive ways also, and destroy people literally with the click of a mouse. Literally, again, one click, and those words are like arrows. David HaMelech already is lamenting this dynamic thousands of years ago. So remember, whenever we study a subject, and you can read the rest of the kapitel on your own, it's really the same basic idea. David HaMelech lamenting the fact that his enemies attack him, but then of course always ending off on a note of positivity, recognizing that although there are those who malign me, who undermine me, who attack me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God has my back. And because God has my back, I know some way, somehow, everything is going to be okay. Whenever we learn Tehillim, we try to focus a little bit on who is the subject of the kapitel. So remember, it's tempting to say that the subject here is David HaMelech, because remember again, thematically, kapitel 64, Samech Talit, very much resembles 63, Samech Gimel, the kapitel, the chapter we did for the last couple of weeks. And again, there the subject was David HaMelech. So in fact, going a little bit out of order, if you look at number 3, Rav Hirsch writes over here, same idea, the psalm refers to the enemies of David, who surround Saul, and who by slanderous calumny fans Saul's hatred for David to open hostility. So if Hirsch understands the Pshuto Shel Mikra, the simple reading of this particular chapter, is that David HaMelech is speaking about himself. He's speaking about himself. I'll tell you what's amazing about Tehillim, is that although Tehillim refers to a number of different chapters in David HaMelech's life, there are two episodes in King David's life which most dramatically impact him. Well, there's more than two, but two primary ones for our purposes today. Number one, of course, is the episode with Bathsheba. which forever changes the trajectory of David HaMelech's life. And number two was the episode with Shaul. And when I say episode with Shaul, protracted episode of Shaul, right? The idea that his father-in-law wanted to kill him. The idea that David, who was such a devoted first soldier, then general, then son-in-law, right? And yet his own mishpacha turned on him in such a dramatic idea. And I've often thought it's very powerful because although there are many important moments in life, more often than not, there are maybe two, three, four pivotal moments in life. There are many important moments, but much fewer pivotal moments. Those moments where literally, again, my life dramatically changes. I don't mean like a person is privileged to have children. Of course, that's a dramatic moment. Is it a pivotal moment? It can be. And you know, on one hand, I'm made into a parent. That's certainly pivotal. But I'm talking about other things which send my life in dramatically different directions, either based on decisions that I make or based on realities which are conferred upon me. So if Hirsch understands that this is just another kapitel in a long series of kapitlach, which speak about King David's difficult, pivotal moments. Bathsheba, Shaul, when everyone turned on me. Everyone turned on me, and I was left alone. They turned on me with their hands. They turned on me with their words. I was all alone, and kind of going back to what we spoke about last week and the week before, in those moments when I was so alone, in those moments of the desert, David HaMelech says something very positive came out of it. What came out of it? You know, times of crisis are often times when you see what? Who your true friends are. The truth is, you know, in life, Rahman al-Islan, when let's say a person endures a loss, so a lot of times you see, it's beautiful to see people come out of the recesses, right? Come out of the woodwork and be there for you. But you know who your true friends are? Your true friends are the people who call you 2 days after Shiva's over. Those are the real friends, right? Because again, when you're sitting Shiva and everybody's out, it's a communal gathering place. But you know, the truth is, the real difficulty in life of rebuilding comes when the Shiva chairs are picked up, the Shiva home closes up, and you have to now, quote unquote, go back to normal life. The real friends are the ones who call you 2 days later, 3 days later, and are still calling you a couple of weeks and a couple of months later as well. David HaMelech, in these moments, and he was totally forsaken and totally alone, when everyone turned on him with words and with hands, something amazing happened. It concretized and solidified his relationship with God. Because he recognized that in those moments when everyone else has turned on me and left me alone, forgotten about me, turned on me actively, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you've always been there. So David HaMelech, to a certain degree, teaches us this incredible paradigm of almost experiencing a spiritual renaissance in the midst of emotional and life turmoil. When you sometimes feel so left alone and so forsaken by everyone else, that's often when you feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God, is most present and most near. Rashi, on the other hand, understands a little bit differently. Rashi, number two, writes something amazing. Shema Elokim b'kol sichi, mizmar zed darshuhu ba'ale agodos tilim al Daniel, shehushlach legov arayos. So others explain that this kapitel is not referring to King David at all. Rather, who is this chapter referring to? It's referring to Daniel, when he was cast into the den of lions. So you're all familiar with this story, the sixth chapter of Sefer Daniel. Daniel was promoted by King Darius, by Daryavesh. The other advisors are very jealous of Daniel's success. They say to the king, we have a great idea, new legislation. What's the new legislation? No one's allowed to pray to anyone other than the king for the next number of days, months, whatever it was. So the king says, fantastic, says, sounds wonderful, what a great way to solidify allegiance. They pass the legislation, and of course they find that none other than the Navi Daniel is davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The king is crestfallen, because he loves Daniel very much, he appreciates him, but a law is a law. They throw Daniel into the den of lions. The king, again, it's actually an incredible passage in Navi, in the sixth chapter of Daniel. So the king is so upset about what he had to do to his most trusted servant. He didn't eat that night. He didn't sleep that night. He runs back to the pit. It's really a pit. They call it a den, but a pit. The next morning, he calls out, Daniel, Daniel, what's going on? Daniel says, Baruch Hashem, I'm still okay. They take Daniel out of the pit. They throw all of the advisors and their families into the pit. That's the end of the story. So Rashi says something amazing. Rashi says that this kapitel is actually a metaphorical allusion to that which would happen to Daniel. If you look at number two, V'yofen nofel kaloshna mizmer al ha'agada, tzafa David beruach ha'kodesh kal ha'ma'orolo. V'hispalel alav she Daniel mizarahaya. So Daniel, who was a descendant of King David devotes a psalm to his anakel, to his great-great-great-grandson, Daniel, that Daniel, when you are in your moment of need, and remember again, Daniel goes through the same thing that David HaMelech went through. Here, Daniel gave his life to public service, which is not a simple thing. He pledged his life to public service, to the service of the king, to Daryovesh, to Darius. He gives everything, and yet what happens? Everyone turns on him, including the king who he had served so dutifully for all of those years, or for all of that amount of time. Actually, it wasn't so long. It was in the beginning of Darius's reign. So this capital, which speaks about people turning on each other with their hands and with their words, Rashi understands is a metaphorical allusion, ultimately, or a prophetic allusion to what would happen with King David's descendant, a great prophet, a man by the name of Daniel. Good. What I want to share with you is another approach. Because what struck me with this capital is, bless you, is the usage of the word sichi. If you look back for just a moment to number one in Pasuk Beis, remember again, the capital begins with the normal opening, Lam Natzeach Mizmor LeDavid. Shema Elokim Kol B'sichi. So the way we translate that is, God has heard my voice in prayer. Now the truth is, we have biblical precedent for this. What's one of the first times that we see the word siach or sichi in the Torah? Truth is, we see it already in Bereshis, right? Forgot the lashon of the pasuk. Terem Yitzmach is the Vichosia Chasada Terach Yitzmach. Terem Yitzmach. So, which talks about over here that the vegetation did not come up from the world, from the earth, before man was able to pray for it. Other notable example is Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basada. End of Parashas Chayisar. Yitzchak goes out to the field, literally translated, to converse in the field. And Rashi says over there again, Ein Sicha Ela Lashon Tfila. So Sicha itself, which again, etymologically, how would you translate Sicha? Conversation, speaking. But again, Rashi understands that in a biblical context, Sicha doesn't just mean speaking, stam conversation. Rather, speaking speaks about dialogical, or I should say, the dialogical connection of prayer. So speaking in the context of prayer. Therefore, again, what we understand is David HaMelech is saying like this, Shema Elokim kol b'sichi. See, hear my voice in my prayer. Hear my voice in my prayer. So there's a couple of interesting questions that one could ask us. Now remember again, I ask these questions not really as, you know, hard-hitting questions, because remember, as we always speak about, Tehillim is poetry. Poetry is very much about word usages. And word usages in poetry need not be exact. The same way, for example, in the Torah, if you have a word that looks extra, there's no such thing as an extra word in the Torah. It's there for some other limud. It's there for some other teaching. You can't say that in Tehillim. Truth is, you can't say that in Nevi'im and Ksuvim in general. They're more of a story. Tehillim, more of poetry. In poetry, you have plenty of extra words. Remember again, if David HaMelech just wanted to say what he meant, how many chapters would Tehillim be? I mean, there'd be one chapter about Shaul. There'd be one chapter about Bathsheba. There'd be another chapter about David HaMelech being plucked from obscurity and cast into a life he did not want. So how many? Maybe three, maybe four, maybe 10 at most. Not 150. But that's the nature of poetry. But nevertheless, still we want to assume the some level of word choice, of word specificity for King David. So it's intriguing to note that David HaMelech could have also just written, Shema Elokim Koli. Hear my voice. Hear my voice. And we would assume voice refers to what? Tefillah. Right? Generally. And David HaMelech does that plenty of times throughout Tehillim. Shema Elokim Koli. Hear my voice calling out to you. But he doesn't say that. Instead he says, Shema Elokim Kol B'sichi. Now I'll tell you something else. The truth is, it sounds like the way it really should have been written is, Shema Elokim Kol Sichi. Hear the voice of my prayer. Kol bisichi literally translates how? The voice in my prayer. What does that mean? So perhaps there's another message that's being conveyed. If you look at the Radak and the Mesudas David, they both point out something very interesting. They say over here that this is not talking about prayer. In fact, they highlight Bisichi, Sichi hu Siper Hatlos, Siper Hatlos. A siach means a story. A story. Right? Or specifically again, Sipor HaTlos means the story of my misfortunes. That's literally. The Metzudas David number 5, Bisichi, Be'es Asaper Talusi. Listen to me when I tell you the story of my affliction. So this is very intriguing to me. Because what the Mefarshim are highlighting is, Koli might mean prayer or might not mean prayer. Sichi might mean prayer, might just mean dialogue. But one thing is clear, which is the statement itself is repetitive. David HaMelech is conveying something different. And therefore these commentaries in 4 and 5 are understanding, David HaMelech is telling a story. He's telling a story. He's conveying a narrative, and he wants his voice to be heard in the telling of his story. So what does this mean? So I think to appreciate this, we're going to go on a little bit of a detour. I actually spoke a little bit about this on Shabbos. But you know, on Shabbos, I can't speak longer than... Ideally, it's supposed to be 15 minutes, but really not more than 22 minutes. So sometimes it's hard a little bit to expound on themes. So sometimes when I start something on Shabbos, I feel a little bit drawn to it over the course of the week as well. So I want to share something that I spoke a little bit about this past Shabbos, and Amir Hashem kind of built on it, because I think ultimately it's what David HaMelech is trying to say. So take a look at number 6. So the pasuk says as follows. So those of you who are here who heard a little bit of this on Shabbos, you'll get a little bit of review. So Vayeti Yakum Ber Shava Vayelech Harana. The pasuk tells us, remember again, a little bit of context. Beginning of last week's parasha, Parashas Vayetze. To appreciate that, go back to the beginning of the previous week's parasha. Remember what happens at the end of Toldos? Yaakov gets the brachos, quote-unquote, steals the brachos from Esav, and the family falls apart. Everything falls apart in the end of Parashas Toldos. Right? Yitzchak realizes he's been deceived. Although again, you know, it's interesting. The Torah is not a storybook. But one of the fascinating dynamics of biblical families is they don't talk about stuff. They don't talk about stuff, right? In fact, the last time we see couples really talk about stuff was Avram and Sarah, right? Because when they get into the debate about Yishmael. But it's amazing. Now, by the way, it could be that they did speak about stuff, but the Torah doesn't tell us. But I'll show you something that I always found exceptionally intriguing, right? Yitzchak is deceived by his younger son. He's actively deceived. And who was Yaakov aided by? Who is he aided by? Not even aided by. Who is he encouraged by? Rivka. He would have thought that in the aftermath of the story, there would have been Yitzchak and not Rivka. Rivka. Or Rivkala. Whatever he called her. Right? Rivka. We probably should talk. We probably should talk a little bit. Right? We probably should talk. But amazingly enough, no conversation. Fast forward a little bit. Yaakov Avinu is on his deathbed. Yaakov Avinu on his deathbed. After Yosef was sold, never once does the text ever record Yaakov asking Yosef, by the way, what's the question Yaakov should have asked Yosef? How'd you get here? How did you get here? The last time I saw you, I sent you to check on your brothers in Shechem. How did you wind up as a viceroy in Egypt? How exactly did that happen? Right? So the commentaries point out that sometimes people don't ask questions people don't ask questions for which they don't want the answers. It's quite possible that Yitzchak did not want to engage Rivka about what happened. And it's quite possible that Yaakov did not want to engage Yosef about what happened. Because the answers to these questions are heartbreaking. And especially in the realm of Yaakov and Yosef ran the risk of totally unraveling the family. Okay, so in any event, at the end of Parashas Toldos, the family falls apart, really falls apart. Esav wants to kill Yaakov. And Rivka tells Yaakov, you have to leave the familial home and you have to go to Haran. You have to run away. So Yaakov goes, Pasuk says, Vayetz Yaakov Beersheva, Vayelech Haran. Yaakov leaves Beersheva, goes to Haran. Vayifka Bamakom Vayolen Sham, Kibah Hashemesh. So he comes to the place. We'll define where that is in just a moment. He slept there because the sun went down. Vayikach me'av mi'hamakom v'yasam erashosav v'yishkav b'makom ahu. So what happens? He takes the stones, makes a pillow for himself, falls asleep, and of course it's that night where what? He has his dramatic dream about the Sulamus of Arza, the ladder that has its base on the earth, its top in the heavens, u'malachei Elokim olim v'yardim bo. And this is Yaakov Avinu's first dramatic conversation with God. As far as we know, Yaakov Avinu never had a prophetic vision before this. This was his first nevuah. This was his first prophecy. His first direct dialogical engagement with God. And it's an incredibly profound dialogue, because it's here where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, the road ahead is going to be difficult, but I promise you I'll never leave your side. There's going to be many ups and downs, peaks and valleys, but I promise I will always be with you. See, here's what's amazing. The Medrash and the Gemara pick up on something fascinating that you could easily miss in the text. If you look, if you look at number six at Pasuk Yud, so the way the Pasuk seems to read is, so the way the Medrash and the Gemara both understand the Pasuk is that Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and he arrived in Haran. He arrived in Haran. He already arrived there. And then what happens when he arrived in Haran? Look at the Medrash in number 7. The Medrash writes, "Vayifka b'makom Amar Yaakov, v'chi afshar avarti al-makom, shespalalu bo avosai v'lo hispalalti." So something amazing happens. Yaakov gets to Haran, and he realizes, oh my gosh, I passed by the site where my ancestors prayed, and I didn't stop there. A reference to what place? Which place? Har HaBayis, right? What is known then as Har HaMoria, right? Har HaMoria, again, is the site of the Akedah, really is the site from which the world was created, the Evan HaShasiyah, the foundation stone from which the entire earth was created, sat in the Beis HaMikdash, according to many, still sits in the Dome of the Rock today, that stone upon which the Ark sat on. The world started from there. The Akedah took place there. And Yaakov says, how could it be that I passed by a place of such significance and I didn't pray there? So what does he do, says the Medrash? Miad chazer lahar hamoriya v'hispal al sham. So this is an amazing footnote in the story. Yaakov, you know, leaves Be'er Sheva, leaves Kinan, gets to Haran, his uncle's home, right, Lavan's home, realizes that he passed by the Har HaMoria, passed by the site of the Akedah, where his father, where his grandfather prayed, and he goes back. He goes back to Har HaMoria. He once again comes back into Canaan, goes back to Har HaMoria. The Gemara adds in an interesting footnote, if you look at number 8, almost identical. The Gemara Maseches Chulin is almost identical to the Medrash, with one interesting idea. So the Gemara says, "Vayitzak Be'er Sheva yelech Haran, vayifka amakom kimata lecharan amar." When Yaakov got to Haran, he said, "Esha avarti amakom shispalu avosai vani lo hispalati." Could it be that I passed by a place of such significance, prayer for my ancestors, for my father, for my grandfather, and I didn't stop there to pray? What happened? Kad yoev daiti lemihadar. As soon as he went ahead and he had in mind to go back to Har HaMoria, kafza le'ara. He experienced what's called kfitzas haderech. God miraculously allowed the journey to be shortened. So the idea is, as soon as Yaakov decided that he was going to go back to Har HaMoria, there was a miracle that occurred. The journey somehow shortened, and Yaakov was able to be, I don't know if it was immediately or instantaneously, but certainly in a much smaller window, able to go back to Har HaMoria, to Davin. He davened, and then of course again the sun sets, he can no longer travel, falls asleep. That's where he has the prophetic vision. The Chiddush HaRin Diger Rebbe asks a very simple question. He says in number 9, Lama be'emes lo ne'etzar toch kidei sha'avar b'pam ha'rishona bo b'makom shispalu bo avosav. So the Chiddush HaRin asks a very simple question. Yaakov, how did you pass by Har HaMoria without stopping there to pray? So in other words, the Gemara and the Medrash are telling us what happened. What happened? Yaakov Avinu is leaving Canaan, goes to Haran, gets to Haran, actually arrives in Haran, then realizes that what? Ah, I forgot. How could it be? I passed right by Har HaMoriah. I didn't even stop there to daven. My father davened there. My grandfather davened there. I didn't even stop to daven there. So what happens? Amazing. He goes back. According to the Medrash, he makes a decision to go back. According to the Gemara, a miracle occurs and is able to be somewhat instantaneously transported back. As to Kedusha, miracles are great. Fantastic. Yaakov, happy you went back. I have a more fundamental question, which is, how did you forget in the first place? How could it be that you're going ahead and you're going to Haran, you pass right by Har HaMoriah, and you don't stop to daven there? How could it be that you forgot? So by the way, the simple answer is, no signs, good. That could be, it's before ways, right? Good, simple answer. He was afraid. Remember again, Yaakov, remember why Yaakov was leaving. Rivka, his mother, told him, Esav achicha misnachim hargecha, your brother is ready to kill you. That's not a metaphor. That's not an expression. That's not a form of speech. That's literal. So it could very well be that Yaakov figured, you know what, I have to get out of Dodge, right? I just have to get out of here. That's the goal. But still, if that's the case, if that was really true, then what? Then why would he come back? So the Chidushim asked this question, and perhaps what the Torah is trying to teach us is something dramatically amazing, which is part of the greatness of Yaakov Avinu is the ability to keep a focus on a goal. Yaakov Avinu understood that as much as he was leading, remember, I think we spoke about this, although I'm not sure, maybe it was this class or maybe the Wednesday night Parsha class. Yaakov Avinu, when he left the family home, was leaving for two reasons, right? His father and his mother gave him two different mandates, right? I think it was this class last week, 2 weeks ago. His father told him, I want you to go to find a shidduch, to find a wife. His mother says, I want you to go, why? Right? Because I don't want your older brother to kill you, right? This was the Vayetse Vayelech idea, the Beis HaLevi that we saw. Two different ideas. There's a third. Yaakov Avinu understood that wherever this place Haran was, that's where his destiny was. Now, how he knew that, I don't know, but he knew it. He understood that he was not his grandfather, but he also understood that he was not his father. He understood that he was a link in the chain, but that his link was going to be something dramatically different than his father and his grandfather. And the truth is, Yaakov was unequivocally correct. What he didn't realize was that he was actually going to be the synthesis of the two. Yaakov Avinu is the synthesis of the chesed of Avram and the givura of Yitzchak. But what he understood was that his destiny was not in Canaan. His destiny lie on the other side of the Yarden, on the other side of the Jordan River. And so when Yaakov goes ahead and he leaves Canaan and he goes to Haran, he is journeying to his destiny. He does not know what that destiny is. He does not know how that destiny is going to manifest itself. He does not know what that destiny is going to look like, but he absolutely knows that his destiny is on the other side of the river. And Yaakov Avinu models an incredible character trait for successful living, which is when you go ahead and you set your eyes on your goal, do not allow yourself to be distracted. You must create a certain level of tunnel vision in life in order to be able to be successful. I'll give you a simple mashal like this. And the truth is, this is so acute for us. I use this example on Shabbos. You know how like in the beginning of the day, it's always good to highlight all the things you want to accomplish, right? I'm going to do A, B, C, D, and E. And everyone knows that if you really want to get a head start on your accomplishments in your day, what must you do? You must shut off your phone. You must. Because you know what happens. You go ahead and you have your whole list for the day. Here's what I'm going to accomplish. This, that. One little email pack pops up. Oh, Black Friday deals on Amazon. Incredible. And then what happens? 3 hours later, I remember, oh yeah, I was supposed to go ahead and accomplish all those other things. Or one phone call, or one email, or one text, which may be all important things. But sometimes if you do not go ahead and develop tunnel vision for the completion, actualization, and accomplishment of your goals, there are so many distractions in life. So many distractions. Which is why for so many of us, we're all good people. I've yet to meet a person, a Jew, who's not good. Some people just wear their good on the outside, and some people have their good buried very deep. But everyone is good. Everyone is good. Everybody wants to accomplish. So why is it that so many of us kind of like run in place? Don't you feel like that a lot in life? I feel like I'm keeping my head above water. I'm not going under, but I'm not really progressing. I'm not really moving forward. The things that I've wanted to accomplish in life are the same things that I've wanted to accomplish for the last 5 years. And why is it that I just can't get the job done? And there are some of us that what we've wanted to accomplish are the same things we wanted to accomplish for the last 20 years in life. And yet, I'm not lazy. I'm working hard. I'm putting in effort. Yet I'm not getting any traction. Why? Because of distractions. And I want to point something out. Distraction, you see, sometimes we think distraction means getting distracted with irrelevant or unimportant things. That's not true. A lot of times the things we get distracted with are very important as well. But in life, if you want to be successful, you have to have a hierarchy of what is important. It's just like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? In Maslow's pyramid, there are a lot of important things, but only one thing goes on the top of the pyramid. So I have to ask myself in any given moment, what is the most important thing I need to do now? Or when I begin my day, what is the most important thing that I have to go ahead and accomplish today? And it can't be five. What is the most important thing? What's number one? What's number two? What's number three? So on and so forth. And then if number one is truly the most important thing, then to a certain degree, I have to put on my blinders. I have to get into tunnel vision mode and plow forward until that is accomplished. Now, sometimes we all know it's much easier said than done because sometimes there are distractions that come up that I must deal with, right? If you get a call from the school that your child has to come home for any variety of reasons, so you know what? I'm really tunnel vision right now, right? I'm really tapped into my destiny. I'm going to call you back in a couple of hours, right? Obviously, it doesn't work. So sometimes you could try whatever you want, but still you're going to get derailed by the distractions in life. And those are important distractions and distractions you have to allow yourself to be distracted by. But there are so many times in life when we allow our dreams and aspirations and goals to be totally derailed because you just get caught up in side stuff. Do you know what happened to Yaakov Avinu? Yaakov Avinu says, I have a destiny. My destiny is in Haran. What is your destiny? I don't know. But I know that it's not here. I know that it's not in this home. And I know for now, it's not even in this land. I know it's on the other side of the Jordan. And so what Yaakov Avinu does is he puts on his blinders. He passes right by Har HaMoriah. Right by Har HaMoriah. Why? Because he has tunnel vision for accomplishment of his goals. And that is an incredible thing. Successful people do not multitask. Successful people do not live on their devices. Successful people tune out everything else and focus themselves on the task at hand. That's how they accomplish. That's how they move forward. And that's how they pile up success after success after success. That's why a lot of times, if we're honest with ourselves, we live mediocre lives. And we live lives that are steeped in mediocrity, not because we don't care, chas v'shalom, and not because we're not willing to exert effort, but because our efforts are diffused all over the place. All over the place. It's an incredible thing. We're in a million different places at any given moment. And because of that, we think that our efficiency has gone up. It's not true. We may be able to do more tasks simultaneously, but first of all, those tasks are lesser in quality. The quality of those tasks is definitely diminished. And more than that, we're task-oriented, but we're not life-oriented. What do I want to do in life? What do I want to accomplish? What do I really want to do today? And how do I focus myself on that task at hand? That was the greatness of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov teaches us what it means to have tunnel vision in the actualization of your destiny. Sometimes in life, you must put on your blinders and full steam ahead. But then something interesting happens, which is Yaakov reaches Charan. He takes off his blinders, and what does he realize? Whoops. Right? I forgot to daven in Har HaMoriah. And here Yaakov Avinu teaches us something dramatic. I want to share with you an incredible article. If you take a look at number 10, this is an article from Forbes magazine back in May. And it's an incredible, it's much longer than what I, not much longer, but it's longer than what I have over here. I just quote a few little pieces of it. Want a life story that truly matters at the end? Here's how to make it happen. First, I love articles like this because it's great. I'm going to spend 4 minutes and my entire life is going to come together through an article. So the truth is, of course, your life can never come together, but yesh chachma bagoyim. There is incredible wisdom in the nations of the world as well. So look at this. Your life story matters more than anything. After all, it's all you've got. Far too often, people get to the end of their lives and realize in hindsight that it wasn't as fulfilling or meaningful as it could have been. They realize that so much time was wasted on things that didn't matter, things that weren't worth it. We hear from wise elders or those living with a terminal condition that our time and money and energy must be spent wisely. We believe this, and yet we forge ahead with the same life we're living, even when the story isn't what we want. We allow ourselves to believe that our future chapters are already written, that hindsight is the only way to know what matters. It's not. Your life story is being written now, in every minute. While we certainly can't predict everything that will happen in our future, or by the end of the day for that matter, we can create a life that's meaningful. Of course, exactly what makes life meaningful will differ for each of us. Whether it's exotic travel, getting into theater, or selling real estate, we're our own unique characters. The point is, we can take steps now to create our own meaningful stories. So I just want to point out something amazing. You know, in the world of therapy, there is something called narrative therapy. And in narrative therapy, what's done is you tell your story and then you retell the story you would like to write. Right? So here's my story. Here's my story as I see it. And here is my story as I would like it to be. Here's the narrative I want. Sometimes like, there's the narrative we have, and sometimes there's by default, and then there's the narrative we want, the narrative we can create. How do you create your story? So Mrs. Maloney, in this article, lists a variety of different ways. I'm just sharing with you the first. She writes, intention, intention, intention. Sometimes situations we chose in the past no longer serve us. Jobs fail to stimulate. Volunteer opportunities grow boring. Relationships turn awkward or tired, maybe toxic. This isn't the problem. It actually makes perfect sense. When you think about it, as we grow and change, so do our interests, needs, and priorities. Or it could be that the choice we made was just plain wrong for us in the first place. The problem is that far too often, we don't stop for a second and take note of what's not working. We just plow through the pages of our story without thinking about whether or not they fulfill us anymore. A meaningful life happens with intention, which means regularly assessing our current chapter and identifying what we do and don't want to continue into the next one. It means taking note of patterns and acting accordingly, easing up, out the stuff that no longer works, doing more of the stuff that does, and finding new stuff to make it even better. In a day and age when we have so many things that pull our attention, we are missing intentionality. We are missing lives that do things on purpose. And I thought that this was such an incredibly dramatic idea. There's much literature written today, this is like a popular topic, of living life with intentionality. Don't allow life to happen to you. Again, of course, there are many circumstances that do just happen to me that I can't control. But as we always speak about, I may not be able to control the circumstances visited upon me, but I absolutely control the narrative as to what I do with that story. You see, too many times we live life as victims of our narrative. Someone else has written a story for me, and I'm just a cast character. And intentionality says, you write the narrative. You may not be able to script all the details of your narrative, but you absolutely control your life story. You are the main character in your main life story. You may not have control over the props, over the set, over the lighting, right? Over so many different things. But at the end of the day, what you do with the set you're given, what you do with the props around you, that is your narrative to write. Person has a choice. You could allow life to happen to you, or you could live life with intention, with intentionality. A life that says, I have to actively make decisions about what I live and how I do things. And just because I've done things a certain way in the past does not mean that I have to continue those modes of behavior in the future. Intentionality sounds a lot like what? Sounds a lot like tshuva, right? This is tshuva. We have everything first. People think they dreamed up into it's tshuva. It's tshuva, just a fancy word for tshuva. Intentionality means just because I've done things a certain way doesn't mean I have to fall into those patterns. Let's plug this into the Yaakov Inu story. Yaakov gets to Haran. So let me ask you this question. You got to Haran. You realize that you passed Hara Moriah. We're amongst friends. This is a safe space. Sure, I remember that's what I mentioned before. You don't have to get into Yetzer Hara. The simple reading is he was running away for his life. That's the simple understanding of it. I agreed. I don't even think you have to bring Yetzer Hara. I think Yaakov Inu could be totally justified in saying, you know what, Hara Moriah, wonderful, incredible. I got to get out of here. My brother wants to kill me. 100%. But again, remember, the Gemara goes out of its way to tell us that when he gets to Haran, he remembered or he realized what he missed, and now he goes back. So leave it out. Leave it out. Just don't tell me about it. If that's the case, leave it out. When Chazal tell you stuff like this, there's a message that's here. There's definitely a simple understanding. But again, we don't want simple understandings. We like complicated, right? We like gut-wrenching, right? We like things that force us to think, right? So over here, so what's happening over here? So imagine this scene. You're Yaakov Inu, you get to Haran. You realize that what? Oh, I didn't stop at Hara Moriah. Let's be honest, safe space. What would you say? Oh, well. Oh, well, right. Well said. You know what? I'm already here, right? It's exhausting. You know, it's probably a holiday weekend. There's going to be traffic back to Hara Moriah. There's going to be this and that. I'm here. God knows my heart is good. My intentions were good. There's so much going on. I'm here already. Hara Moriah. I'm going to make sure to stop by on my way back. Right? And by the way, I think that's 9 out of 10 people would think that way. Do you know what the greatness of Yaakov Avinu was? It is true, he had tunnel vision for his destiny, but he also lived a life of intentionality. Yaakov Avinu said to himself, I missed something, and I missed something really important, and I missed something really special, and I missed something that could have dramatic ramifications for me. So yes, am I justified in saying, oh well, right? I just forgot, a little absent-mindedness, a lot going on in my mind and in my heart right now. Of course. But that would have been Yaakov Avinu allowing life to happen to him. Instead, Yaakov Avinu chooses to live a life of intentionality. I missed something. The tunnel vision is great, except in the small print of tunnel vision, you'll read, sometimes tunnel vision causes you to lose out on opportunities along the way. Yaakov Inu realizes, I needed the tunnel vision to get to Haran. I feel like I made a mistake. Not that I actively made a mistake. I feel I made a mistake. So Yaakov Inu could have easily said, oh well, but he doesn't. Instead, what does he do? He packs back up and goes back. That's a life of intentionality. That's a life where you make strategic, organized decisions. That's a life where you don't allow life just to happen to you. Because you know what oh well is? You know what the translation of oh well actually is? You'll look it up. Oh well, translation, I have no control anyway. Right? That's oh well. Oh well is the greatest statement of victimization. Oh well, right, it happened. What am I going to do? You yield the reins of intentionality when you say, oh well. And Yaakovina says, you know what? I'm not going to be that kind of person. I could be the kind of person who has tunnel vision to get to my goals, but I could also be the kind of person with intentionality that says, when you make a mistake, you don't have to perpetuate it. You could reverse and you could redo, or you could pledge not to do it again going forward. Past behavior need not be indicative of future results. And so Yaakovina makes an active decision to go ahead and go back to Hara Moriah. That's living life with incredible intentionality. And I'll tell you something amazing. Notice I quoted for you on the sheet both the Medrash and the Gemara, although they're seemingly saying the same thing, but I'll tell you something dramatic. The Gemara adds in a detail that the Medrash did not. What's the extra detail in the Gemara? Kafza lo haderach. The Gemara says that when Yaakov Avinu went ahead and decided to go back to Hara Moriah, what happened? What happened? God stepped in. God did something miraculous and somehow contracted the journey. Do you know what the message is? When you decide to live a life of intentionality, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help you actualize your goals. If you're going to be an oh well person, God always helps us. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you're yielding the reins of your life, then the truth is, it's not that much for me to do anyway. But if you want to take the reins and live a life of intention, live an existence of intentionality, don't let life happen to you, but you happen to life. You make decisions. You decide who you want to be, what you want to be, what you want to accomplish. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you do that, if you're heroic enough to make that decision, I'll partner with you in allowing ultimately your dreams and aspirations to come true. So if we bring this all back together, so just an idea, it's not our topic for today and we're pretty much out of time, but there is an incredible, as I mentioned before, an incredible amount of literature discussing this concept of living with intentionality and how you live with intentionality. Things like creating a plan, like hopefully all of us engage in estate planning. Right? Same way I have to have life insurance and I have to have a will and I have to know exactly chas v'shalom what will happen with my children if I am not here. All of those things, we all do estate planning for after 120. We forget there's another piece of planning. It's called life planning. Right? It's not only about what happens when I die. There's a much more important, just as important plan, which is what happens when I'm alive. What is my plan for life? What is my plan for life? Like, what do I want to accomplish? Who do I want to be? Often that begins by setting goals. What are my daily goals? What are my weekly goals? What are my yearly goals? And actually articulating and codifying and concretizing those goals and asking myself at the end of the amount of time, did I reach those particular goals or did I go ahead and miss them? And if I missed them, why did I miss them? Becoming organized. You can't progress in life unless a person is organized. And organization comes naturally to some and is an incredible avoda for others. But if you're not organized and you're always, as they say in Latin, zufliegen, right? And you're always all over the place, right? And you can't find this, you can't find that. You know, there are some people that spend their whole lives looking for their keys, right? Their whole lives looking for keys, right? They're looking for keys, they're looking for kids, they're looking for this, they're looking for that. In life, you have to have a seder. Seder is the most important thing. Order. And that's order in every area. In order in how we present ourselves, in order in how we keep our homes, in order in the way we conduct our families, and in order in the way we lead our lives. Seder is exceptionally important because without organization, you cannot progress in life. And lastly, which maybe is the first thing, a commitment to change. You can't lead a life of intentionality if you're happy with status quo. If you're okay with coasting, if you're okay with putting on cruise control until 120, then you will never have a life of intentionality. Only those who are committed to change and constant change, daily change, even hourly change, that's the recipe for success of intentionality. What does this have to do with David HaMelech? So perhaps if we take this all the way back, go back to number one for just a moment. And with this, we'll conclude. David HaMelech says in Pasuk Beis, Shema Elokim, Kol Bisichi. Perhaps what David HaMelech is saying is like this. You know, when a person encounters traumatic and dramatic life circumstances, They often feel like their life has been hijacked, and understandably so. Something incredibly difficult is happening to me. I feel like I've been robbed of my life. Everything has been taken from me. And it's easy to go ahead and say, the narrative, it's no longer my narrative. Someone else or something else is writing this narrative. It's no longer my life story. I no longer have control. David HaMelech says, I refuse to yield to that. Rather, what does he say? Shema Elokim. God, I want you to listen. Kol Bisichi. I want you to hear my voice in my narrative. My voice in my narrative. There are many people in my life who are doing things to me. And many people in my life who are mistreating me. And many circumstances that I cannot control. And many things that are being foisted upon me. And many handicaps that I must deal with that are not of my own making. But I refuse to yield my narrative to someone else. I refuse to let someone else write my story. I refuse to let someone else dictate how I deal with my circumstances. I refuse to yield my intentionality. No matter what is happening in my life, it'll be my voice that dictates my narrative. It'll be my voice that leads a life of intentionality. Look how the pasuk ends. Mipachad oyev titzor chayai. Even though, again, I live with fear of the enemy, you shall guard my life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because I know. How do I know? I know from Yaakov Avinu. That when you choose to live a life of intentionality, what happens? What happens? Who becomes your greatest partner in life? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When Yaakov Avinu decides to lead an intentional life and go back to Har HaMoriah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm going to partner with you. Together we'll do something great. David HaMelech says, there are many things in my life that I can't control. My narrative, my story, who I am, what I am, what people will say about me, what they'll say about me in 120 years from now, that I control. And that voice of my narrative is something I will never yield. No matter how difficult life becomes, no matter how much the cacophony of tragedy around me keeps amplifying, I will not give that up because I know that if I live a life of intentionality, then titzar chayai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you will be by my side and help me through whatever it is. And so David HaMelech teaches us this overwhelming, inspiring, and incredibly important lesson of living life with intentionality. Don't let life happen to you. You must be the voice in your narrative. You must be the author of your narrative. While it is true that you cannot choose so many of the aspects of your story, but ultimately, again, the important parts, like who you are, who you become, and what you accomplish in life, are all up to us. We'll stop over here. Meretz Hashem will continue in Perek Samech Dalet for one more week next week.
The part with Hashem, like joining you, I don't think it's true because.